Howard sang.
The tribes of the Porpoise are fearless and strong. Our land is the ocean, our banner's a song. Our weapon is speed, and our nose is like rock. No foe can withstand our terrible shock.
A cloud of Porpoise bodies swam out from somewhere behind Hagbard's submarine. Through the pale blue-green medium which Hagbard's TV cameras made out of water, they seemed to fly toward the distant spider-like ships of the Illuminati.
"What's happening?"
said George.
"Where's Howard?" "Howard is leading them,"
said Hagbard. He flipped a toggle on the railing of the balcony on which they stood in the centre of a globe that looked like a bubble of air at the bottom of the Atlantic Ocean.
"War room, get missiles ready. We may have to back up the Porpoise attack." "Da, Tovarish Chelin,"
treble voice. The Porpoises were too far away to be seen now. George discovered that he was not afraid. The whole thing was too much like watching a science fiction movie. There was too much illusion involved in this submarine of Hagbard's. If he were able to realize in his glands and nerves that he was in a vulnerable metal ship thousands of feet below the surface of the Atlantic, under such enormous pressure that the slightest stress could crack the hull and send water bursting in that would crush them to death, then he might be afraid. If he were really able to accept the fact that those little distant globes with waving legs appended to them were undersea craft manned by people who intended to destroy the vessel he was in, then he could be afraid. Actually, if he could not see as much as he was seeing, but only feel and sense things and be told what was happening, as in the average airplane flight, then he would be afraid. As it was, the 120,000-year-old city of Paos looked like a tabletop model. And though he might intellectually accept Hagbard's statement that they were over the lost continent of Atlantis, in his bones he didn't believe in Atlantis. As a result, he didn't believe in any of the rest of this either. Suddenly Howard was outside their bubble, or some other porpoise. That was another thing that made this hard to accept. Talking porpoises.
"Ready for destruction of enemy ships,"
said Howard. Hagbard shook his head.
"I wish we could communicate with them. I wish I could give them a chance to surrender, but they wouldn't listen. And they have communication systems on their ships that I can't get through to."
He turned to George.
"They use a type of insulated telepathy to communicate. The very thing that tipped off Sheriff Jim Cartwright that you were in a hotel room in Mad Dog smoking Weishaupt's Wonder Weed."
"You don't want them too close when they go,"
said Howard.
"Are you people out of the way?"
said Hagbard.
"Five big rhinoceroses, six big rhinoceroses."
"Of course. Quit this hesitating. This is no time to be a humanitarian."
"The sea is crueler than the land,"
said Hagbard,
"sometimes."
"The sea is cleaner than the land,"
said Howard.
"There's no hate, just death when and as needed. These people have been your enemies for 20,000 years.
"I'm not that old,"
said Hagbard,
"and I have very few enemies."
"If you wait any longer, you'll endanger the submarine and my people."
George looked out at the red and white striped globes which were moving toward them through the blue-green water. They were much larger now and closer. Whatever was propelling them wasn't visible. Hagbard reached out a brown finger, let it rest on a white button on the railing in front of him, then pressed it decisively. There was a bright flash of light, dimmed slightly by the medium through which it travelled, on the surface of each of the globes. It was like watching fireworks through tinted glasses. Next, the globes crumbled as if they were ping-pong balls being struck by invisible sledgehammers.
"That's all there is to it,"
said Hagbard quietly. The air round George seemed to vibrate, and the floor under him shook. Suddenly, he was terrified. Feeling the shockwave from the simultaneous explosions out there in the water made it real. A relatively thin metal shell was all that protected him from total annihilation, and nobody would ever hear from him or know what had happened to him. Large, glittering objects drifted down through the water from one of the nearby Illuminati spider ships. They vanished among the streets of the city that George now knew was real. The buildings in the area near the explosion of the Illuminati ships looked more ruined than they had before. The ocean bottom was churned up in brown clouds. Down into the brown clouds drifted the crushed spider ships. George looked for the Temple of Tethys. It stood intact in the distance.
"Did you see those statues fall out of the lead ship?"
said Hagbard.
"I'm claiming them."
He hit the switch on the railing.
"Prepare for salvage operation."
They dropped down among buildings deeply buried in sediment, and at the bottom of their television globe, George saw two huge claws reach out, seemingly from nowhere, actually, I guess, from the underside of the submarine, and pick up four gleaming gold statues that lay half buried in the mud. Suddenly a bell rang, and a red flash lit up the interior of the bubble.
"We're under attack again,"
said Hagbard. "Oh, no," George thought. "Not when I'm starting to believe that all this is real. I won't be able to stand it. Here goes Dawn doing his world-famous coward act again." Hagbard pointed. A white globe hovered like an underwater moon above a distant range of mountains. On its pale surface, a red emblem was painted. A glaring eye inside a triangle.
"Give me missile visibility,"
said Hagbard, flicking a switch. Between the white globe and the Leif Erikson, four orange lights appeared in the water, rushing toward them.
"It just doesn't pay to underestimate them, ever,"
said Hagbard.
"First, it turns out they can detect me when they shouldn't have equipment good enough to do that. Now I find that not only do they have small craft in the vicinity, they've got the Zvak herself coming after me. And the Zvak is firing underwater missiles at me, though I'm supposed to be indetectable. I think we might be in trouble, George."
George wanted to close his eyes, but he also didn't want to show fear in front of Hagbard. He wondered what death at the bottom of the Atlantic would feel like. Probably something like being under a pile driver. The water would hit them, engulf them, and it wouldn't be like any ordinary water. It would be like liquid steel, every drop striking with the force of a 10-ton truck, prying cell apart from cell and crushing each cell individually, reducing the body to a protoplasmic dish rag. He remembered reading about the disappearance of an atomic submarine called the Thresher back in the 60s, and he recalled that the New York Times had speculated that death by drowning in water under extreme pressure would be exceedingly painful, though brief. Every nerve individually being crushed, the spinal cord crushed everywhere along its length. The brain squeezed to death, bursting, rupturing, bleeding into the steel-hard water. The human form would doubtless be unrecognisable in minutes. George thought of every bug he had ever stepped on, and bugs made him think of the spider ships. That's what we did to them. And I define them as enemies only on Hagbard's say-so. Carlo was right. I can't kill. Hagbard hesitated, didn't he? Yes, but he did it. Any man who can cause a death like that to be visited upon other men is a monster. No, not a monster. Only too human, but not my kind of human. Shit, George. He's your kind of human, all right. You're just a coward. Cowardice doth make conscience for us all. Hagbard called out.
Howard, where the hell are you?
The torpedo shape appeared on the right side of the bubble.
Over here, Hagbard. We've got more mines ready. We can go after those missiles with mines like we did the spider ships. Think that'll work?
It's dangerous,
said Hagbard,
because the missiles might explode on contact with the metal and electronic equipment in the mines.
We're willing to try,
said Howard. And without another word, he swam away.
Wait a minute,
Hagbard said.
I don't like this. There's too much danger to the porpoises.
He turned to George and shook his head.
I'm not risking a goddamn thing. They stand to be blown to bits. It's not right. I'm not that important.
You are risking something,
said George, trying to control the quaver in his voice.
Those missiles will destroy us if the dolphins don't stop them.
At that moment, there were four blinding flashes where the orange lights had been. George gripped the railing, sensing that the shock wave of these explosions would be worse than that caused by the destruction of the spider ships. It came. George had been readying himself for it, but unable to tell when it would come, and it still took him by surprise. Everything shook violently. then the bottom dropped out of his stomach, as if the submarine had suddenly leapt up. George grabbed the railing with both arms, clinging to it as the only solid thing near him.
"Oh, God, we're going to be killed,"
he cried.
"They got the missiles,"
Hagbard said.
"That gives us a fighting chance. Laser crew, attempt to puncture the Zwack. Fire at will."
Howard reappeared outside the bubble.
"How did your people do?"
Hagbard asked him.
"All four of them were killed,"
said Howard.
"The missiles exploded when they approached them, just as you predicted."
George, who was standing up straight now, thankful that Hagbard had simply ignored his episode of terror, said,
"They were killed saving our lives. I'm sorry it happened, Howard."
"Laser beam firing, Hagbard,"
a voice announced. There was a pause.
"I think we hit them."
"You needn't be sorry,"
said Howard.
"We neither look forward to death in fear, nor back upon it in sorrow, especially when someone has died doing something worthwhile. Death is the end of one illusion and the beginning of another."
"What other illusion?"
asked George.
"When you're dead, right?"
"Energy can neither be created nor destroyed,"
said Hagbard.
"Death itself is an illusion."
These people were talking like some of the Zen students and acid mystics George had known. If I could feel that way, he thought, I wouldn't be such a goddamn coward. Howard and Hagbard must be enlightened. I've got to become enlightened. I can't stand living this way anymore. Whatever it took, acid alone wasn't the answer. George had tried acid already, and he knew that while the experience might be wholly remarkable, for him, it left little residue in terms of changed attitudes or behaviour. Of course, if you thought your attitudes and behaviour should change, you mimicked other acid heads.
"I'll try to find out what's happening to the Zwack,"
said Howard, and swam away.
"The porpoises do not fear death. They do not avoid suffering. They are not assailed by conflict between intellect and feeling, and they are not worried about being ignorant of things. In other words, they have not decided that they know the difference between good and evil, and in consequence, they do not consider themselves sinners. Understand?"
"Very few humans consider themselves sinners nowadays,"
said George.
"But everyone is afraid of death."
"All human beings consider themselves sinners. It's just about the deepest, oldest, and most universal human hang-up there is. In fact, it's almost impossible to speak of it in terms that don't confirm it. To say that human beings have a universal hang-up, as I just did, is to restate the belief that all men are sinners in different languages. In that sense, the Book of Genesis, which was written by early Semitic opponents of the Illuminati, is quite right. To arrive at a cultural turning point where you decide that all human conduct can be classified in one of two categories, good and evil, is what creates all sin, plus anxiety, hatred, guilt, depression, all the peculiarly human emotions. And of course, such a classification is the very antithesis of creativity. To the creative mind, there is no right or wrong. Every action is an experiment, and every experiment yields its fruit in knowledge. To the moralist, every action can be judged as right or wrong, and, mind you, in advance, without knowing what its consequences are going to be, depending on the mental disposition of the actor. Thus, the men who burned Giordano Bruno at the stake knew they were doing good, even though the consequence of their actions was to deprive the world of a great scientist. If you can never be sure whether what you are doing is good or bad,
said George,
aren't you liable to be pretty Hamlet-like?
He was feeling much better now, much less afraid, even though the enemy was still presumably out there trying to kill him. Maybe he was getting Darshan from Hagbard.
What's so bad about being Hamlet-like?
Said Hagbard.
Anyway, the answer is no, because you only become hesitant when you believe there is such a thing as good and evil, and that your action may be one or the other, and you're not sure which. That was the whole point about Hamlet. If you remember the play, it was his conscience that made him indecisive.
So he should have murdered a whole lot of people in the first act?
Hagbard laughed.
Not necessarily. He might have decisively killed his uncle at the earliest opportunity, thus saving the lives of everyone else. Or he might have said, "Hey, am I really obligated to avenge my father's death?" and done nothing. He was due to succeed to the throne anyway, and if he'd just bided his time, everyone would have been a lot better off. There would have been no deaths, and the Norwegians would not have conquered the Danes as they did in the last scene of the last act. Though, being Norwegian myself, I would hardly begrudge Fortinbras his triumph.
At that moment, Howard appeared again outside their bubble.
The Zwack is retreating. Your laser beam punctured the outer shell, causing a leak in the fuel storage shells and putting excessive stress on the pressure-resisting system. They were forced to climb to higher levels, which put them so far away from you that they're now heading south, toward the tip of Africa.
Hagbard expelled a great sigh of relief.
That means they're heading for their home base. They'll enter a tunnel in the Persian Gulf, which will bring them into the great underground Sea of Volusia, which is deepest beneath the Himalayas. That was the first base they established. They were preparing it even before the fall of High Atlantis. It's devilishly well defended. One day, we'll penetrate it, though.
The thing that puzzled Joe most after his illumination was John Dillinger's penis. The rumours about the Smithsonian Institute, he knew, were true, even though any casual phone caller would get a flat denial from Institute officials. Certain high-placed government people could provide a dispensation, and the relic would be shown in the legendary alcohol bottle, all legendary 23 inches of it. But if John was alive, it wasn't his. And if it wasn't his, whose was it?
Frank Sullivan's,
Simon said when Joe finally asked him.
And who the hell was Frank Sullivan to have a tool like that?
But Simon only answered,
I don't know, just some guy who looked like John.
Atlantis also bothered Joe after he saw it the first time Hagbard took him for a ride in the Leif Erikson. It was all too pat, too plausible, too good to be true, especially the ruins of cities like Paos, with their architecture that obviously combined Egyptian and Mayan elements.
Science has been flying on instruments like a pilot in a fog ever since 1900,
he said casually to Hagbard on the return trip to New York. This was in 72, according to his later recollections, fall of 72, almost 2 years after the test of Aum in Chicago.
You've been reading Bucky Fuller,
was Hagbard's cool reply.
Or was it Kozybski? Never mind who I'm reading,
Joe said directly.
The thought in my head is that I never saw Atlantis any more than I ever saw Marilyn Monroe. I saw moving pictures, which you told me were television reception of cameras outside your sub. And I saw moving pictures of what Hollywood assured me was a real woman, even though she looked more like a design by Petty or Vargas. In the Marilyn Monroe case, it's reasonable to believe what I'm told. I don't believe a robot that good has been built yet. But Atlantis... I know special effects men who could build a city like that on a tabletop and have dinosaurs walking through it, and your camera's trained on it. You suspect me of trickery?
Hagbard asked, raising his eyebrows.
Trickery is your métier,
Joe said bluntly.
You're the Beethoven, the Rockefeller, the Michelangelo of deception, the Shakespeare of the gypsy switch, the two-headed nickel and the rabbit in the hat. What little liver pills are to Carter, lies are to you. You dwell in a world of trap doors, sliding panels, and Hindu rope tricks. Do I suspect you? Since I met you, I suspect everybody.
Glad to hear it.
Hagbard grinned.
You're well on your way to paranoia. Take this card and keep it in your wallet. When you begin to understand it, you'll be ready for your next promotion. Just remember, it's not true unless it makes you laugh. That is the one and sole and infallible test of all ideas that will ever be presented to you.
And he handed Joe a card saying, there is no friend anywhere.
Burroughs, incidentally, although he discovered the 23 synchronicity principle, is unaware of the correlation with 17. This makes it even more interesting that his date for the invasion of Earth by the Nova Mob, in Nova Express, is September 17, 1899. When I asked him how he picked that date, he said it just came to him out of the air. Damn, I was just interrupted by another woman collecting for the Mother's March against hernia. I only gave her a dime. W, the 23rd letter, keeps popping up in all this. Note, Weishaupt, Washington, William S. Burroughs, Charlie Workman, Mendy Weiss, Len Wineglass in the conspiracy trial, and others who will quickly come to mind. Even more interesting, the first physicist to apply the concept of synchronicity to physics after Jung published the theory was Wolfgang Pauli. Another suggestive letter number transformation, Adam Weishaupt, A.W., is 1 to 23, and George Washington, G.W., is 7 to 23. Spot the hidden 17 in there? But perhaps I grow too imaginative, even whimsical.